The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Howard today. Dan needs to leave promptly at 1 o'clock. And this is just, of course, the beginning of our four-part series, which is the 3L, 4L Career Forum, really designed to sort of address some of the macro problems, or in a macro environment, some of the issues and challenges the graduating student faces. Typically, that is to say, you're not atypical, it's not indigenous to this group. This is a program I've done, and Dan's joined me for the last couple of years in assisting and presenting it, because it really anticipates and deals with the typical employment cycles and dynamics of a graduating class, not particular to WCL and American, but to every and any law school out there. Dan makes presentations similar to this in law schools around the country, or has in a few law schools throughout the country, and so I just wanted to sort of put a mindset in your head that, you know, what you're going through now vis-a-vis the employment search, the job search, is a natural market dynamic, but that's not to say that there aren't issues that you're each facing or individually facing that can't be more effectively addressed, and I dare say that usually is the case that I and the office can address better in a one-on-one conversation. And I have worked with several of you here, hopefully to your benefit. And I encourage you all to make an appointment with me. I do the alumni counseling, but over the last few years, I've branched out more aggressively into the soon-to-be alumni, the graduating class. So really, I'm sort of your go-to guy. That's not to say that if you have a relationship with a counselor in the office, you need to divorce that, you can continue that. But for those of you who haven't been in the office for a while or need to get on in there, I encourage you to come down, make an appointment with me, and let's move forward that way. Today is the first of a four-part series. We're going to deal with the market trends, perspectives, and common mistakes today. Dan's really going to share with us some insights on his analysis of the various markets, sort of broad strokes, maybe nationally, but more specifically to the D.C. metro area. And rather than just go through an A to Z litany of all the practice areas, you want this to be driven by your interests, your needs. So in 1 minute or less, I'll be soliciting that with respect to, hey, I'm interested in antitrust specifically. I'm interested in criminal defense. I'm interested. So I want to hear from you about with respect to those interests, not only in the markets, but maybe even geographically, recognizing that there's going to be another portion of this program, as you see, as you don't see, because I haven't handed these out yet. As you'll see on the front page, if you wouldn't mind, thanks. The packet materials here, this is a part of a four-part series. The next program is going to be on public sector employment opportunities on March 1. Dates and rooms are TBA. We're having some difficulties given Founders Celebration and actually securing rooms, so you'll hear from us. And then Dan is going to again join us on March 29th for a third session, the long distance job search and working with attorney search firms. So we'll really keep that topic for that date. And then the fourth session on April 12th, dealing with contract lawyering post-law school. I'd like to insert on March 28th there Donna Gerson's program. It's not necessarily part of this package, but it makes absolute sense for any of you who are considering small and mid-sized firms. She's really literally written the book on getting a job at the small and mid-sized firm. And on March 28th, we'll be having her, proud to host her here. So look just FYI, put it on your calendars, and you'll be getting more information on these programs. So without further ado, let's hear from you folks with respect to sort of two things. One, your interest in which markets, that is, what practice areas are you interested in hearing from me and Dan about, or Dan and I about, and what are some difficulties or perceived mistakes that you've made to date or with respect to your job search efforts?
Everyone here, third or fourth years?
Shoot, I didn't even introduce Dan.
Oh, that's okay.
A 2000 alumnus of WCL, started his career doing intellectual property work, trademark and copyright work, specifically with Finnegan Henderson, a very large firm, national, international firm, before several years later moving on to his current position where he is the managing director of the D.C. offices of BCG Attorney Search, an international attorney search placement firm. Dan's really an expert in this field, and really fortunate to have him with us today. So, but go out there and solicit that, Dan.
Yeah, what, how many people by show of hands are third years? How many people are fourth years, part-time? Second years? First years?
Should all be third.
Okay, good. So we know who we're dealing with here.
Yeah, definitely the graduating student. So, the market interests. Let's hear it. Yes?
Immigration, and particular business immigration.
Okay, immigration. Go. Let's see, just shout it out.
Securities.
Securities. Okay?
Consumer bankruptcy.
Consumer bankruptcy. Okay?
Corporate.
Any more specific than just corporate itself, or just generally? Okay.
Criminal law?
Criminal prosecution?
IP,
anything specifically there? Is it
trade
patent?
Okay. Soft IP.
Banking.
Others?
Probate and estate planning.
Okay. T&E, I'll put trust and estates.
Transactional.
Legislation. When you say legislation, you mean legislative affairs or you mean policy?
No, I mean politics.
Okay, legislation, okay, Hill, I'll put sort of, right?
Yeah.
Okay, policy, got it. And then corporate, including transactional and general. Okay. Any others?
Civil rights litigation.
Maybe this wasn't a good idea, Dan. No, this is great. I don't know, you know, obviously we'll be dealing with quickly on each of these in broader strokes because there's a lot to cover here, but let's definitely hear it. Any others that we're missing?
Criminal defense.
Okay. Grand prosecution defense. Okay. And, you know, they could evolve as we go through. Now, how about similarly, any issues that you face out there repetitive issues or first-time issues that really seem to be red flags, like, geez, I'm never going to get a job because this keeps happening to me, or I'm just not penetrating the market, or things that you want to share so we can sort of discuss things in the context of your specific difficulties, because God knows you're not the only one facing it. Who's brave enough? Yes?
Finding firms that are hiring.
Okay. Okay, who else?
The idea that a lot of people don't hire, want to hire immediately, but, you know, then you can't really apply until after the bar.
Okay. Post-bar employment dynamic. That's really good. Okay, great. Other issues? Craig?
I guess combining the first two a little bit, the firms that maybe targeting small or medium don't know yet. They don't know if they're going to hire yet.
Okay. Firms hiring. Firms uncertain hiring needs. At present. Others.
Emphasizing legal grades over non-legal experience.
Grades. Grades and experience. Legal and non. Okay. I don't see any trends or. Okay, good. In the packet of materials, it's just not really a hodgepodge, but it's a bunch of different information in there. You'll see, though, the first page, I put forth a bunch of common mistakes and issues that come up in the job, in the 3L job search process. And I'm only going to spend 5 minutes or so going over them again in sort of broad strokes. But, you know, keep putting a lot of these things here because keep seeing them, and they're just sort of natural dynamics, and they happen every year. And I dare say that if Dan were to put a list together with what he faces in the lateral market, I'm sure there'd be a huge overlap. I'm sure there'd be a huge overlap because these issues are not specific and exclusive to the job-seeking student, but they sort of go on with you throughout your job search history, your career going forward. If it's news to you, then so be it, but the fact of the matter is, statistically speaking, it is highly unlikely that interview is going to remain with your first employer post-law school throughout your legal career? I mean, some of you may, but do you have a statistic on that, Dan? Or
Very small.
Right, very, very small, and that's statistical precision. That's what we offer here. But the reality is, and sometimes you lose that sort of objective and recognize that, and sort of put so much emphasis on that first job that you really miss the fact that, hey, you want to get the best job possible, the highest paying job possible, in the best city possible. That's going to offer you the most relevant experience. But given all those variables, there might be some give and take. And you might want to approach sooner rather than later which needs to give, which needs to take at this point in your career. Not that you're sacrificing anything necessarily, but you're making some educated job search decisions. And again, approaching these at this point in your career, all well and good, because these are job search skills that you're going to need 2, 3, 8, 12 years from now. Hopefully much fewer of these skills, because by 2, 3, 8, 12 years from now, you will have built up a solid network, a solid reputation in the legal community that will sort of offer its own benefits. So going through some of these, I've been babbling a lot here, Dan. Let me just start with the networking end, because these are sort of talking points.
Sure,
sure. You can jump on in. But networking, you've heard it a zillion times, blah, 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 networking. Having said that, it is so bloody important, and it is so underused, and it is so ineffectively executed. But again, I mean, have you met with the professors that are doing the kind of work that you want to do? Have you met with your former employers? A lot of times it's like, I know I need to do this, but, now's the time to do it, your last semester. Let's get this stuff going. Are you using the mentor database, the WCL alumni, your undergraduate alumni effectively? And, you go down through the list. But the fact of the matter is, many of you have done it, or have done it sort of herky-jerky with no methodology, and it breeds that kind of inefficiency. One of the attendees here today just sort of printed out an email that the student sent to me. I'll read it just because it highlights this point specifically. Thank you for meeting with me, Matthew, on Tuesday morning. This is day before yesterday. You provided lots of helpful advice. I'll be very busy picking up the job search. I sent the letter we discussed to Mr. So-and-so. Unfortunately, he is out of town this weekend and is even not quite sure he will be hiring new associates. Now, we had worked with a student to look at a specific job position in New York, but would still be game to speak with me generally when he returns from travel. Upon your advice, I asked him if he had any contacts at the list of firms he provided initially. He responded with both contacts and said I could use his name. Bingo. I drafted a short email to everyone and received a couple of hits. This is 48 hours ago. One for this Friday at noon, and one to be scheduled for next time I'm in New York City. So this is just an email I got from someone here today who is, just an anecdote to say that doing this effectively, doing it methodically, can and will bring fruit.
If I can add one point about that, who here, by show of hands, agrees that advocacy is an important skill as an attorney? And doing this networking, going out and meeting people, is the best way that you can introduce yourself as an advocate for yourself. Because in the real world, if you can't advocate for yourself, if you're not good at getting from A to B or meeting the right people, or going out and putting yourself in the marketplace and really advocating on your behalf in a persuasive way, that does not indicate strong advocacy skills. Now, a lot of people, I'm not saying if you don't do this, you're not a good advocate, but a lot of people don't put two and two together and realize that I can show off my advocacy skills as a good lawyer through using this job search. I can show my good writing skills, my ability to follow up, my gentle persuasion to get something done and to find results. A lot of people say they do that, but when it comes to their job search, their actions don't indicate that they're advocates for themselves. So if you think about it, this is really part of the fundamental DNA of a good lawyer, is being an advocate. And if you can do it for yourself, there's much more of a chance that people will believe that you can do it for your clients.
And that builds into another point in here, one of the bullet points of poor pitch, either written or oral. That is to say, if you're not presenting yourself effectively, if you're not showing a focus, if you're contacting people, interviewing them at an informational basis or for a job, I can't tell you the number of mock interviews I've conducted with 1Ls, 2Ls, 3Ls, and eighth-year associates, then some, where the presentation is really off. They don't understand how they're coming across, how ineffectively they're coming across. And, you know, that's working with me. And we could oftentimes, I could sort of serve as a mirror to highlight that and show you how to fortify your presentation, not just oral, sometimes written, et cetera. But as Dan said, I mean, you're presenting yourself to a prospective employer as saying, hey, this is the best I've got. I'm as prepared as I can be. I'm meeting with you. And the employee's saying, wow, this is as good as you got. You know, thanks, but no thanks. You know, again, a lot of these things you sort of have in the back of your mind saying, sure, yeah, I understand what you're saying. But in execution, you'll be surprised how often candidates fall short.
Oftentimes, I think it's just, I know from my personal experience, there's certain things that are uncomfortable, kind of like putting together a writing sample, dusting off your old resume. These are things that inherently most people don't get excited to do because it's somewhat stressful and it makes you really examine things, and often mock interviewing is like that. It's kind of easier to say, you know what, I'll just get there and wing it on the interview, because I know for me when I was in law school, the idea of doing a mock interview, I just didn't have the patience to realize everything I was doing wrong. And it was easier just to sweep it under the rug, say, you know what, I'll just go in there and wing it. So I understand if any of you feel that way, because I felt that way. And a lot of candidates that I work with right now who are coming from big firms to go to other firms have that same sort of reluctance to really unpeel the onion and make their pitch perfect. But if you're feeling that, just kind of be aware of that. And that's one of those stumbling blocks that a lot of people don't realize until it's too late. And it's, you'll always feel better if you take some time to really examine it and perfect the pitch and those other things, even though first you'll realize that, you know, there are a lot of things that need to get improved on, but you'll feel much more comfortable afterwards.
Let's turn to some of these, Dan. Looking at the difficulties that students are facing in the trading marketplace, firms, are they hiring? How do I identify firms that are hiring? By the way, how does it couple in with one of these bullet points about only looking at job postings? But let's really concentrate on how do I identify firms or organizations that are hiring? Some ideas.
The first number of things you can do, there are obviously, you guys have job posting resources here. Job
eCampus board, Recruiter.
eCampus Recruiter.
Lawcrossing.com.
Yeah, Lawcrossing. Lawjobs.com. A lot of these boards that are posting for laterals and not entry level. So I think oftentimes firms will, or other employers will target law schools, and those are for the entering level positions. You know more about those.
I would supplement and say that good for you for asking. You know, how do I find out who's hiring? Well, one obvious is to look at job postings and the zillions of sites that are out there. But you know, again, a lot of you folks aren't even using the basic stuff that's available to you here. And again, I'm not shame on you. I'll have this conversation next year as I had it 4 years ago. So it's the same dynamics. Looking at eCampus, there's attorney jobs online. There's Law Crossing. There's so many postings. But as Dan said, many of them are for lateral. But there are definitely, you want to look at the job postings, but you need to understand that, looking at that pie chart on this third page there, the second page therein, you know, how many of the typical class of 2005 get their jobs from job postings themselves? 17%. I mean, it's a significant number, but 32%, you know, a third of the class gets them from an outreach targeted campaign, from networking, from identifying firms that are hiring that never said they were hiring. So how do you do that? Well, again, on a one-on-one basis, have a more intimate conversation about what your target is, et cetera. But in a broad stroke sense, you need to first identify your market, what's your practice area. Second, who are the likely employers in there, public side versus private side. And then third, identifying alumni therein and or key players therein that you want to concentrate, approach, And then fourth, doing that. To the extent that none of those take, to the extent that there isn't that common denominator between you and the organization, you move to plan B, which is letting other people who you're doing outreach with know who those targets are, the way that one of your colleagues did here, so that that person can say, you're looking at that firm, or you're looking at that organization, or that prosecutor's office. Similarly with us, if we have alumni there, et cetera, you know, we'll share this information with you. But we don't know unless you tell us specifically, and sometimes that's the issue itself, is, you know, you don't know specifically, you're still sort of in this somewhat gelatinous phase of focusing in on a practice area. And again, that's sort of the natural dynamic as well. I mean, not all of you know exactly the position where you want to go, but we need to work on that. So the post-bar exam dynamic.
Thing about firms that are hiring.
Yeah.
When I started recruiting, the owner of our company said to me, every firm is willing to hire if you can make a case as to why it benefits them. So obviously, it's harder to do that if you're doing a mass mailing. But if you think about it, it really is, if you can present why you make sense to a firm through your background, through your experience, through people you know, by knowing their practice, there are a lot of places that don't have active needs because it takes a long time. Firms will have a hiring need for a long time before they post a need. Mm-hmm. They will say, gosh, we're really overworked. We need to hire somebody. And then if nothing happens, a couple of weeks later, they'll say, we need to talk about running an ad. Then a couple of weeks later, they'll say, oh, we haven't run that ad yet. We need to get something. And then a couple of weeks later, and throughout that six-week period, they've probably gotten 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 resumes from people that could be qualified. So a lot of times they don't even have to post an ad because people have been hitting them and planting seeds throughout the process. So to wait for an opening is often, sometimes it's too late.
Right. And I got an email today. The director of the office forwarded to me from a 2L, who did precisely that with his interest in antitrust law, expressed them creatively to targeted antitrust firms. No job postings, they weren't hiring anyone. Follow up with a phone call, he got the job. He got a job that didn't exist, and so he's going to be doing antitrust law this summer. It does work. It will not always work for you specifically. No, that's the non-guarantee. But you have to put together, you have to know the tools that are out there and use them according to what's most likely to work in your targeted area and given what your interests are. And that, again, is sort of the micro campaign.
Right.
Post-bar employment dynamics, as a matter of fact, there are, especially the smaller firms and the smaller agencies, the smaller NGOs, that don't hire, thank you very much, until the bar results are out. That's just knowing your market, knowing and understanding that that's a natural market dynamic. Are you telling me, Matthew, that I might not be employed until like November or next? Absolutely. As a guarantee, a population of this graduating class, and I could say this in almost every law school, but perhaps not Harvard and Yale, where you write your name on a crayon, write your name on a crayon and a piece of paper, and they'll hire you just by name only. Not to say that they stick around a long time. You know, they'll get hired right out of the box, but they don't always perform up to speed. But yes, depending on what your target is, the fact might be that that kind of employer doesn't hire, can't afford to hire you until they know that you're a member of the bar. Because they can't afford, they have one person to hire, they need that attorney to go into court the next day. So if that is a factor in the market that you're looking at, you just have to understand that, know for it, brace for it, and anticipate it. That can be a reality. Firms in certain hiring needs at present sort of touched on that. But grades and how to pitch yourself when the grades aren't great. You deal a lot on the lateral level with folks that have probably some pretty stellar grades. Or not? I don't know.
Well, yeah, most of the people I work with, we can only really work with people that are have towards the top of their class. What's interesting though is everybody thinks that their grades aren't good enough. I was speaking with someone that worked in a law firm that did interviewing at some of the top Ivy League law schools. And as a sociological experiment, all she would do is just they'd come in, she'd say, tell me about your grades. And they would always, I think, 8 of the 8 people apologize. And these were people that were top 5%. So everyone thinks that their grades aren't good enough. The worst thing you can do is apologize for your grades. They are what they are, and if there are other mitigating factors, such as you work through something happened. You mention it matter-of-factly, but if a firm is interviewing you and talking to you, obviously the grades weren't enough of an issue. You got a foot in the door. So I think people spend way too much effort worrying about grades when it's like worrying about yesterday's weather. There's absolutely nothing you can do about it. And if you come in there feeling defensive, apologetic about it, that's when it's a problem.
And there's nothing you can do with the past history, the sum cost of grades, if you will. But there is something you can do about the real question behind the question, you know, tell me about your grades. That is, excuse me, are you asking me my overall GPA being a 3.18, or are you really asking me am I smart enough to do the kinds of securities law that you want to do? And that's really the question behind the grades question. And that's the question you answer. Well, in my overall GPA, there are a number of ways, again, depending on the dynamics of your GPA performance, are there upward trends? You got nailed your first year. You did okay your first year, but you got a C in Civ Pro. By the way, this position has nothing to do with civil procedure. You did well. There was a hiccup in this area. I mean, there might be reasons to discuss, not apologies and not defensive posture, but putting the question in context. But as I said in the beginning, do you really want to know, wouldn't it be more interesting to know how I did in these four classes, in securities reg, in BA, in IBT, and in tax, because I'm really, really interested in being a corporate / transactional lawyer. And in those classes, I have, you know, three A's and an A minus. So there are ways to work with your grades, and there are ways to show the employer that, hey, grades are what they are, but the fact of the matter is I can do the work academically. I've done the work.
That's a fantastic point about the question behind the question.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. It's really true.
Okay. Put that on for the record. Experience versus non-legal, same way. A lot of folks apologize or poo-poo the non-paid for, the non-remunerated experiences that they had, or they don't even consider it an internship that they did. The employers aren't looking at, again, this is from public sector to Hogan and Hartson. They're not looking at whether or not you got paid or necessarily the name of the organization that you worked at or firm that you worked at. They're looking at what was the day-to-day. What did you do? You did this on a volunteer basis as part of your student bar membership at the ABA's energy law section. That's pretty interesting to me, given that you want to be a regulatory lawyer, given that you want to do energy law. Sure, put that on your resume. So, you did it. You did this non-legal work. You worked at an accounting firm. You worked at this kind of organization. There are no doubt some very highly transferable skills that you can extract from those positions if you know what they are, and if you do that effectively, and if you market them, prepare them, present them effectively in your paperwork, cover letters, resumes, as well as in your pitch orally through the interview. Again, it's by nature of our 55 minutes together here, we're sort of fast-forwarding through a lot of stuff, but we just want to make sure we punctuate some of these issues, bring them to your attention, and at least recognize that, you know, this doesn't have to be an internal process where you're agonizing about this, and all these issues are just specific to you. They're not. They're very broad issues that law students and beginning lawyers face, and the better news is that there are effective ways to deal with them. So again, we're just sort of edifying you on them, about them today, and trying to put them all in context. Questions or comments about that before we jump on into the market trends.
Can I say something about grades?
Please.
My grades are not very high in terms of like the class ranking.
Yeah.
But when I go to apply for jobs, I was doing like a lot of apologizing because of that, and I have gotten a lot of in like national job searches a lot of compliments on my grades. So I think people at in particular need to realize that your GPA, how it places you at like the Washington College of Law ranking,
right,
is very different than how you compare it to students at other schools.
Because,
I mean, just for example, like a 3.5 here may put you in like the bottom 75% of the class, but nationally that's really good.
Right. And that's an excellent point, again, with respect to how do you present this stuff. I am not, if a 3.5, I don't think it's bottom 75%, but for example, it's not as high as you think it would be. You're right. I mean, it's. But so the point is, for God's sake, Don't put the ranking on. Put the 3.5. Are you kidding me? Most lawyers, practitioners in small and mid-sized firms and public organizations and federal agencies, the non-mega firms that are like 3.8 and better, so that means 80% of the real legal employers out there, would be very pleasing a 3.5, thank you very much. It's a strong GPA. Oh, geez, it's only, middle of the class at WCL? Shoot, you just undermine your own candidacy by even parenthetically noting that on the resume. Take that part out. Just put it in the 3.5. So, yeah, why make yourself a less appealing candidate when you don't have to put in information? Not saying being disingenuous and don't be ethical about things, but there's no need to disclose everything related to the grade, especially when their GPA is.
Yeah, if you disclose the top half when you don't need to, that undermines your advocacy skills. They'll say, this person's not advocating effectively on their behalf.
Doesn't even know how to spin the a positive fact set of facts in their own light. Should we just dive right in?
Yeah.
What do you think, Dan?
I wanted to
just highlight that. Yeah.
There's a chart that I put in here. There are four pages here. I wanted to just
the last four pages of the document.
This is a chart going through practices, usually at large firms. So I want to explain, take this with somewhat of a grain of salt because it doesn't apply to all cities. It applies just to D.C. and generally in the large firms. And what I did was a lot of people talk about what's hot and what's not. And I think that can be a little bit misleading because the practice area can be really hot, but because it's so hot, there's tons of people applying to these positions. And because tons of people are applying to these positions, they're very competitive. So what I did here is I put some of the primary practice areas on the left-hand column, and then in the second column it says the market size. If it's a large market, that means there are usually a lot of positions. If there's a small market, that means there are not as many positions. However, you also need to keep in mind the hiring demand, because if there's a high hiring demand, that's better for you. And if the pickiness, that's another thing, how much of an emphasis there are on credentials. You know, for example, appellate law, there's a very strong emphasis on credentials. And then the sexiness factor, which I call, obviously sexiness factor is the last column. The sexier a practice area, the more people want to do that type of work, kind of like entertainment law, things like that. So I put all these other columns in here so that your information can be a little bit more narrow and focused, and you'll have more context, not just relying on, I heard IP is hot, so I'm going to go try to get an IP position because it's hot. The best thing for you is if you go to a large market where there's a high hiring demand that's not sexy and not as picky, because that increases your chances. I mean, if you want to play the odds solely without regard to what you like, that's just one way to analyze it. But what we could do is just go through these practice areas, and I can
use this as a launching pad. No?
Yeah,
can we do that? Immigration, for instance.
Let's start.
Is that the first one up here?
Immigration, yeah. That's on the second page here. The market size is pretty small for larger firms. There are only a few firms a few larger mid-sized firms that have immigration practices, because the reason is that it's not a type of area where our clients pay a lot of big bucks, and so the larger firms often refer that out to smaller firms, immigration boutiques. The hiring demand is growing because of all of the visa issues as a result of the Homeland Security. It's harder to get into the country, so a lot more companies are using immigration law firms. The pickiness, it's not that picky to get credentials. Prior work experience in helping in immigration is very, very valued, especially work where it involves counseling, helping people on a one-on-one basis. Who mentioned business immigration? Do you have a background in that area?
I do, and I currently work in
this right now. Okay. So, that's great. I think, there are firms that have immigration practices. They're just not, it's not one of the key firms. And also some employment firms have immigration practices, Jackson Lewis and, a number of employment-based firms have the immigration side practices.
How about Maggio Qatar? I was I think he's an adjunct here. He's certainly an alum of the school. We have a half a dozen in one of the most prestigious boutique immigration law firms here in town. Have you done outreach to?
I actually have a contact. We're going to be doing something on Friday.
Excellent. All right, so you're moving forward with that.
Right.
And then again, depending on what else you've done and what your resume looks like, we could really hash out what other steps to take. But that's business immigration law, which is practiced in the private sector versus public immigration law, which is, sorry?
No public immigration.
Right, which is a separate beast, lives more in the nonprofit world, lives in legal aid, lives in NGOs, and that's a sort of asylum refugee issues. But business immigration law, which is motivated by a business incentive to get someone with a certain job set skill into the country because we don't have enough nurses, we don't have enough engineers, we don't have enough yada yada.
Right.
And again, in the D.C. area, so driven by engineering, Beltway Bandits out there, north of Grumman, I mean, you have all these high-tech businesses and industries that require that. So it's a pretty healthy market, and it's a matter of getting, I mean, we have WCL, we have classes here, we have, look at this, February 2007, Immigration Reform and the American Identity, front page. I mean, if you're not, who wants to do criminal law? This was last month. How to Become a Prosecutor. This is a DC Bar magazine. I would be leveraging my butt off of these magazines in terms of who wrote these articles, what are they saying in here, what are the CLE programs involved in here. I mean, it's a front page cover, and looking at just this as a jumping point to what are the who are the contacts and how to do outreach to folks that are related to this. Oh, by the way, there might be some information in here that might be of interest.
Right.
Securities. Maybe we should wrap up the securities corporate transactional into individually.
Securities. There are two types of securities generally. There's securities enforcement / litigation, and then there's securities finance. Who asked about securities? All right. What when you say you're interested
in working in the enforcement and SEC?
Okay, that's a huge area right now. Let's see what we put. It's a large market size. There are a lot of opportunities for people that are doing SEC enforcement type of work because you got to follow at least on the larger firm side, and I think on smaller firms as well. If you follow the money, if you see what's going on in the newspaper, what are the cases? And there's been a lot of securities fraud issues over the past couple of years. Companies accordingly are nervous. So there's a lot of money in that area for law firms to make advising companies. There's a big hiring demand. It's a big market.
What about outside of D.C. and New York, like, say, in Detroit, Chicago?
Good luck, kid.
Actually, I know someone, one of my candidates came from Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have probably the commodities markets there. So if you look at Midwest America, Detroit or Chicago, you're going to have Detroit. I mean, it's more Chicago-oriented.
Right.
You probably have a more vibrant.
Yeah, I mean, where they're banks, so there are, wherever you go, there are going to be opportunities closer to the big cities, obviously. But your background at the SEC is going to be really useful. I mean, that's going to get you noticed.
But yes, the point is very true, regardless of the practice area. Hey, if you want to do securities law and you're striking out D.C. and New York off the list, you've just narrowed, the bad news is you just narrowed your opportunities exponentially. The good news is you've created a super focus. That is, because there are only fewer places to do it in your select cities, you can very easily target your campaign. But you have to recognize that, no matter how targeted and precise your campaign is, there might not be a need in a very small market for that kind of background.
Or if there's a need, you may really be unique. And those are the places I wouldn't wait for. I would send my resume to Miller Canfield, for example, a really good Detroit firm that's has securities enforcement work. Places like that, they may say, "Huh, wow, this is someone that's coming from the SEC. We don't see many of these people."
Absolutely.
And that's why being in D.C. can be really advantageous if you take advantage of the internships.
I don't think you could have a more powerful something on your resume that enforcement SEC, if you wanted to do going out, exporting that the sexiness of the SEC on your resume vis-a-vis securities law to any place, you know, west of the Mississippi. I mean, it's because they don't get a whole lot of that, and it's, unless they have a regional center there, et cetera. And that's easy to identify where the regional offices are, federal agencies.
General corporate finance, corporate transactions, which include, you know, securities, IPOs, you know, when companies want to go public, or, you know, private companies, securities, or mergers and acquisitions, that sort of falls under the umbrella of corporate. That's been really hot in D.C. It was very slow from 2002 to 2004 during the slowdown in the economy, but it's really picked up a lot. Now, what's very beneficial for people going into corporate is if you have prior experience, whether it was in another field in finance, something that shows that you're familiar with finances and companies, if you had previous experience working in a company on the business side, things like that, have an MBA, that can be useful to offset if your grades don't fall within that particular, you know, echelon, because a lot of the firms of corporate practices, they're pretty picky in terms of grades, so having that other type of background can be really useful.
By the way, it's securities law or it's immigration law, just fill in the blanks. But geez, Dan, my grades aren't so great. I don't have a whole lot of experience at the SEC, and I'm not sure if these firms are hiring. But again, so you went to a four-part series, Defending Securities Investigators, Internal Investigations. You put that on your resume. You went to a CLE program. You got to get this stuff for free now. Put on your resume. Drafting corporate agreements. Sixth Angle Institute on Securities Regulation in Europe. Antitrust seminars, et cetera. These are opportunities that you have a unique opportunity now to take, given that you're a student, you get this stuff for free, and you have the time on your hands. I understand, you know, there's lots going on in your lives, but these are sort of quick fixes to help really amplify, magnify the amount of experience you have or are lacking on your resume and in conversation, and to show in your cover letter that, hey, this kid's really interested in doing this stuff. I mean, she's going to these programs or she's attending these webcasts. I'm not saying schlep up to New York and do these things. A lot of these stuff you can do teleconference or participate on web. But it's those little things that can give you the competitive advantage over someone else who just has a couple of classes. You have a couple of classes and these.
It's absolutely true. I mean, that right there is absolutely potent, which a lot of people just don't take advantage of. And if you do, it shows so much during an interview. It shows so much on your resume. And I work with candidates that are looking to change practice areas. And I won't talk to them unless they've got several CLE programs and in a new section on their resume showing that they're committed to this area. And the amount of time it takes to go to one of these is going to far outweigh the chances that spending 2 hours studying, in a course and reading a couple cases, this is going to carry so much more weight. And, you know, don't tell any of the teachers telling you this, but it really is true that this, it's very powerful.
Corporate, prosecutorial defense, criminal prosecution and defense side.
There are two types of criminal defense in D.C. There's the white-collar criminal defense, which is practiced at most of the larger firms. And then there's the, they call them, you know, street crime, critical criminal defense, the smaller types of cases. The big firms in D.C. do not handle drunk driving, negligent, you know, types of criminal issues, assault, battery. Those are usually handled by much more smaller firms. You see them around courthouses. They call them street crimes. The white-collar crime, those are really, it's kind of like corporate crimes. You're doing a lot of reviewing securities documents, and it's business crime. It's banking crimes. It's very high-level white-collar. So that's important to realize that you're not going to be able to go to a mid- or large-sized firm and be in court every day doing street type of crimes. If you like the idea of being in court every day and defending people that, you know, criminals or accused criminals, it's really important to go to a smaller type of firm where you're going to be able to get in court and do criminal defense?
We're having a program. A woman who used to be work in the Office of Career and Professional Development is now the chief recruiter for the D.C. Public Defender Service. So she's going to be here with a bunch of others. For those interested in the defense side of things, look for that coming up in March. I'm just always happy to talk on an informational basis with WCL students. I jumped over consumer bankruptcy. Similarly, you know, a practice that does intend to live at the big firms, it's a much more, it's a smaller firm kind of practice, or a legal aid kind of practice, that is consumer bankruptcy. And that is something that you can, you know, just follow interest rates. As soon as those variable rate mortgages start hiking, consumer bankruptcies will absolutely spike. Interest rates go down, money is easier to get, consumer bankruptcy tends to go away. For those of you interested in it, it's the kind of thing that you know, it's on the rise now, unfortunately. I think there's a record number, although they're surprised there aren't even more. But it's the kind of practice that I've seen you need to sort of create a portfolio of practices to buffer the downturns in consumer bankruptcy, which sort of ebbs and flows. So a lot of times people put in another kind of financial kind of practice in that, marry it with real estate or something like that, even on a sort of the residential side, because again, consumer bankruptcy tends to live in that smaller milieu. Soft IP?
Soft IP is attractive. It's very, very sexy, because if you've taken trademark or copyright or e-commerce, they're sexy issues. You're dealing with companies, brand names that you see all over the place. Who asked about soft IP? Do you have a interest?
Yeah, I worked at a big firm in my second summer. I'm just not sure I want to do it.
Oh, well, it's...
But I'm still thinking.
It's not, if you don't have a science background, there are not that many opportunities, frankly. There are opportunities, but it's becoming harder and harder to get those opportunities. It was really hot in 98, 99, 2000, 2001. There are firms that are hiring entry-level trademark people, but usually it's best if you have some experience either at the patent and trademark office, the copyright office. In D.C., if you're doing soft IP, odds are it's trademark law. There's not much copyright law in Washington, D.C. There's not much entertainment law in D.C., not too much e-commerce. There are certain practices, but by and large, it's doing trademark, either litigation or counseling and prosecution of applications. And the best way to get experience during law school is an internship at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. But if you guys are third years, probably, you know, we're past that point. But you can get a job as an examiner at the Patent and Trademark Office when you graduate, and that's a good way to get some trademark experience. You know, some people are able to lateral into law firms from the Patent and Trademark Office. But overall, it's very sexy, and there are not as many opportunities as people may think out there.
And you'll want to also, with all these practice areas, but I'll just choose soft IP to make the point, look at the other federal agencies beyond the PTO, the Copyright Office, for trademark issues, such as the Smithsonian, such as the U.S. Postal Service, Legal Department, the Cracker Jack Legal Department. Lots of IP issues with respect to Ella Fitzgerald's face on a stamp, Elvis's image this way, that way. So there are IP lawyers, soft IP lawyers working in these. Smithsonian, you know, taking this artwork over from England, or you're appropriating... you want to appropriate an image for posters, et cetera. These practices live vibrantly in the federal government, in other agencies than those that you perhaps no-brainer, knee-jerk reaction, you know, look at. And an excellent resource for you is online through the Federal Careers for Attorneys guide that's online that you have access to through your Westlaw account, through the Attorney Jobs online hyperlink, that you'll only have until you graduate, because after that you'll pay $20 a month, because we can't offer it after that, $20 a month for these subscriptions. So again, are you maximizing the resources that are here for you while you're a student? I throw that at you. Trust in estate work, I see that lives in large firms. It lives also in small boutique firms. It's pretty much immune from market ebbs and flows. It pretty much demands an LLM in tax. Now, again, broad strokes, generally speaking, you can always prove me wrong, but that's generally speaking the T&E picture. We have a lot of alumni that do it. I've worked with alumni that do it. Happy to talk to you about that. mega firms. I started one of the largest trust and estate firms up in New York. We dealt with the Bush family. We dealt with Andy Warhol's estate. I didn't do any of it. I did corporate litigation. But folks that were hired, so it lives in that kind of environment, but then also lives in the mom-and-pop law shops and the smaller boutique firms where they're just doing the targeting certain net worth individuals, or it's part of an everyday practice that is, you know, mom and dad just want their parents just had a child and they want $5,000 a flat fee, they need a whole estate plan. So it lives in all those different areas, but really a tax background is compelling.
And what I've noticed in the D.C. market, they do have mega firms that do this, but they're really not that. They're very small parts of large firms that focus on the real high net worth individuals, and there are not that many people that are that rich that can use a firm like Covington & Burling or Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman. So it's very rare that I get a request for a trust and estates associate. I think, you know, maybe two I've gotten over the past couple of years. Most of those positions, by and large, are smaller firms in Bethesda, Rockville, in the suburbs of Maryland, 8, 10, 12 people firms. My father's an estate planning attorney. You know, so that's be careful going into large firms saying that you want to do estate planning unless you know that they've got a particular need for somebody, because you'll be better off probably targeting more of the boutiques firms for that.
Legislative Affairs, Hill, and then we'll try to do banking and civil rights too, but Legislative Hill / policy.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah.
You can skip it, because I know I have a pretty good handle on what I'm doing.
Okay, good. Because I was about to say that.
Maybe you can teach me a thing.
I'm sure you could teach us. But, you know, again, hyperlinks to the no-brainer stuff, the Hill Zoo, the roll call. There are places that are jobs posted. You have to go up on the Hill, post your job at the Senate placement, Congress. You know, you usually don't get jobs that way. It's knocking on the doors. It's getting in there. You're talking to folks if you want to be on the Hill specifically, versus sort of advocating a specific interest. That is, I really do want to advocate these kinds of issues. Which trade organizations, which professional organizations, which entities are involved in those issues? So you're working with the entity itself in advocating for those issues, and or working in a law firm that has a legislative affairs branch, and or a policy shop that's just a lobbying shop out there. These are all no-brainer ways to get in, say nothing about the federal government and state government that have legislative affairs policy offices in them as well. Banking law. What do you want to say about banking law?
Banking law is generally a pretty hot area because there are not that many people with experience, and it's kind of a niche area in which there's a high desire. So if you do have a banking background, or you're interested in it and do have relevant experience prior to law school or during law school, it's a pretty hot area, but it's hard to break into if you don't have any experience and you don't have very good grades, because the people that are in banking law are pretty hardcore corporate people. So it's a lot of banking in New York. More in D.C. it's very regulatory, but there are some firms that do have banking practices. It's but grades are pretty important in those groups.
And civil rights litigation, depending on how you define it, can include obviously the Office of Civil Rights and Department of Justice, but everything else therefrom, again, human rights violations, NGOs that are prosecuting that kind of stuff, plaintiffs, injury firms, domestic violence issues on the private side. Lots of different ways that you can do civil rights related work, legal work related to civil rights issues, again, depending on how you define civil rights. And recognize that, again, if the Office of Civil Rights is your raison d'etre after law school and you don't have the GPA to get into the honors program, very competitive place to be. There are certainly things you can do to make yourself an attractive candidate 3-4 years of post-law school. Again, sort of circling back to the original statement that the first job post-law school might not have all the bells and whistles that you wanted to have, but as long as it's putting you on the right trajectory, that can oftentimes serve a very valuable next step. So I know there's a lot of stuff here to sort of rush on through, et cetera, and we do want to respect Dan's time. Thank you all. Are there any sort of last-minute questions you want to throw this way before?
Your search firm is just isolated to D.C., so I wonder if you would have a chart like this for other searches.
Well, if you go to our website, bcgsearch.com, you can. There's a newsletter that you can receive, if you, and we do a quarterly newsletter going through all the different legal markets, talking about hot practice areas and all that. So pretty much every legal market in the country you can find. You won't find a chart this detailed, but you'll find overviews of, you know, the active areas.
Do you have an archive of those newsletters?
Yeah.
Could we email you with our...
Yeah, if you go on, you can probably just search like BCG Attorney Search Newsletter, and they're all online. So you could find them that way.
Other questions, comments, retorts?
Okay. Thank you all for coming again.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Dan. I'm happy and anxious to work with each one of you. Just
wondering if you have